Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Today's show begins with an interview with author Michael Norton. He'll talk about some ways each of us can have a positive impact on the ecosystem.
You, in your own country with your own money, doing something for someone else to change their life is much better than giving to a big non-profit.
Also, WFPL Stephanie Sanders brings us three installments of her series of interviews with each member of Louisville's Metro Council.
We all try to agree on a particular issue, whether the folk on the other side of the aisle sponsor it or whether we sponsor it, but I don't know what go on in their caucus.
And WFPL Susan Sweeney Crum learns more about Mayan culture and why they think the world's going to end on December 21st, 2012.
When the sun is right there, then it opens up the gateways into heaven, and all the souls that are waiting, they ride the canoes into the heavens and become gods.
Now the news. Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL Stephanie Sanders continues her series of interviews with members of Louisville's Metro Council. First, people in more than 175 countries are celebrating Earth Day today by taking part in various activities to clean up the environment. WFPL's Julie Goodwin spoke with Michael Norton, author of 365 Ways to Change the World, How to Make a Difference One Day at a Time. In it, he outlines some unique ideas for improving the world.
In your book, you mention numerous ways, numerous things people can do to actually change the world. What would you say are the top five ways?
Wow.
you can narrow it down.
Let's try and get a mixture of things. We don't want to be all environmental or all this or all that. One of the things I really like to start off with is something really simple, where you can, for example, go to the rainforest site and you can click on an icon and you actually save one square meter of rainforest. I think that's absolutely brilliant. And it works because the site sponsor pays for each person who visits the site. And you actually do release money by doing that. So I think that's great. The second thing is that there are people all over the world who are trying to make something of their lives. And we can actually help, not by giving them money, but by lending them money. There's a website called Kiva, KIVA.org, and you go to it, and it offers you a chance to invest in an entrepreneur in a developing country. For example, a lady in Ghana wanting to start a dairy business needs $500 to get going. You can lend some or all of that, and when she gets as much as she's asked for, she gets the money, she starts her business, and as she begins to make a success of it, then she begins to pay back the loan, and you get a chance either to get your money back or to invest in someone else's future. And I think that sort of a direct link between you in your own country with your own money doing something for someone else to change their life is much better than giving to a big non-profit. Make amends. Through our life, we collect people that we've done wrong to in some way.
Sure.
And we can just say that we're sorry. I think that's a great thing to do. I put it right at the beginning of my book. I think it's January the 2nd. Because you never know what might happen. And someone wrote to me saying that they had made amends to someone as a result of reading this in my book. And that someone said that they worked for Google, and Google had this partnership with nonprofits, and my friend was working for a nonprofit and became a Google partner. So the good deed that she did came back to her with knobs on, as it were. So I think that was great. I don't want the book to be 100% serious. I want people to have fun changing the world. So the next idea is just a fun thing to do, which is to change the world with the roll of a dice. Set yourself different things you might do and different ways of doing them, and roll dice and decide which to do. you never know what might happen. And it's like the butterfly flapping its wings and creating a tornado somewhere else in the world. Have a hunger banquet. Oxfam America have got this great scheme for raising money. Now, they're raising money for hunger in the world, and it would be inappropriate to ask people to organize very sort of swish dinner parties with candles and all the trimmings. So what they do is they suggest you invite 19 people to dinner, and of those 20 people, three of them will get a really good, lovely meal. They'll get drinks before, they'll get chocolates after, and they'll really enjoy themselves. Another five of them will sit on cushions on the floor and have beans and rice. And the rest of them will have, as it were, either rice or bread and water sitting on a cold stone floor. And you draw lots to decide who is going to be which. And you all contribute, let's say, $20 for the evening. And that proportion of 3 to 5 to 12 mirrors the situation in the world. 15% of the world is reasonably well fed, or very well fed. 25% is adequately fed, and the other 16% go to bed hungry each night. And it's a really nice way of raising some money. So that's five at random, really.
Obviously, many people around the world are celebrating Earth Day today. What are some things that people can do to make the planet just a little better?
Well, I think the first thing is to understand that the Earth is under threat from our, the population pressure, the way we live, the way we use resources. And we're consuming resources as if there were there was more than one planet we could draw our resources from. And if we had to just consume the resources that our planet has to offer, we'd really have to cut our living standards quite substantially. So the first thing, I think, is to understand the issue. Now, I went to hear Al Gore speak about an inconvenient truth the other day, mm-hmm. and he's really inspiring, and he produces facts and figures and photographs and stories about a world under threat. And if you're not convinced by that, then you never will be. Mm-hmm. So get his book or get the DVD and see the video. And then the next thing is that we can measure our ecological footprint. And there's a website called myfootprint.org where you can do this. And it just tells you how much more of the Earth's resources you're consuming as a family or as an individual than there are available. And it hasn't mattered so much in the past, but with the growth of China and India, huge countries with rapidly increasing standards of living, it's going to make our standards of living completely unsustainable. And then the third thing I say is that one should do one small thing today to reduce our impact on the planet. Now, when I was last in America, Walmarts were launching their campaign for low-energy light bulbs. So the first thing you could do, a little thing, is to switch to low-energy light bulbs. Switch one bulb. That's a starting point. You could switch your whole house. You could get all your friends to switch. And you will notice it in your electricity bills, and it will pay for itself within a year or two. And after that, you're in profit, as it were. But it will also mean that there'll be fewer blackouts because the power stations won't be under stress every summer when air conditioning's on full. And it'll mean that we're doing a little bit more for the planet. So that's one little thing. And there are lots of little things that you can do that will reduce the amount of energy you consume. Another idea is to plant seeds. And I've got two ideas here, really. One is called guerrilla gardening. Armed with trowels, seeds, and vision, you can garden anywhere and everywhere. And I like the idea of planting seeds on little bits of uncared-for land. It could be around the base of a tree in a public space. It could be in a crack in the pavement. It could be anywhere. If you plant the seeds and water them for a bit, and when they come into blossom, it's absolutely fantastic, and you'll feel really pleased. And every day when I cycle into the middle of London, I pass a guerrilla garden, and I smile every time I pass it. We've got a non-profit in the UK called Land Life, which actually promotes the idea of spreading wildflower seeds on derelict land and creating wonderful carpets of colour. And if you are interested in seeds, you can grow seeds for the world. There's a French organization called the Coccapelli Seed Foundation, mm-hmm. and they encourage people everywhere to grow seeds and to send them in, tomatoes, melons, lettuces, beets, carrots, pulses, almost any species they will find a home for. So they give you instructions, you grow seeds and you send them, and it's a seed bank for feeding the world. And then I was at a lecture the other day, and the someone from the Butterfly Conservation Trust was speaking, and he said that butterflies are an advance warning of things going wrong on the planet because they breed very fast and they're very visible, so you can tell from butterfly populations whether the climate is changing, for example. And what they do is they encourage people to adopt a patch of land, a five-yard-wide strip, and you walk maybe a couple of miles along that strip, and you record the butterfly populations as you walk. So you go for a walk once a week and take a record of the butterflies and send them in to the Butterfly Conservation Trust. And this contributes to a database, which is a sort of advance warning on climate change. And then pick up one piece of litter today. This is from Finland. They started the litter movement. Mm-hmm. Instead of sitting around looking at the dirty streets, just do something. You don't have to clean every street everywhere, but if you pick up one bit of litter and if you get someone else to pick up one bit of litter, you're beginning to start a litter movement. And the idea behind my book and the idea behind everything that I'm trying to do at the moment is to say that we can make a difference by doing things. We don't have to sit and wait for big government or big business or big community organizations to do things. We, the citizens of the world, can actually make a difference. And lots of little things done by lots and lots and lots of people can make an absolutely huge difference.
And I guess that's the real message here, that many of us think that it takes something huge to truly make a difference, but as you're mentioning and as you mentioned in your book, that is just not so.
Yeah, I mean, something like global warming is a huge, huge, huge problem.
Sure.
And to be realistic, we can't make that much of a difference, but if we do something, it does make a bit of a difference. And if lots of people do, it makes a bigger difference. But it also presses those who have greater power than we do to change what they do. When they see that the public actually is behaving in a particular way, it influences how they behave. It's very interesting how food supermarkets now are stocking fair trade coffee and tea. And this has been based really on a consumer movement of people going out and buying fair trade. And the big supermarkets, who are the really big purchasers of coffee and tea, now know that there's a huge market for it, and they want to be part of it. So it's become the norm, actually, that tea and coffee should be fair trade, that the producers should be paid fairly for producing it for us. And I think that's really started by a few individuals doing their little thing of going into a shop and saying, when they're buying coffee, please, I want fair trade. And if you go to Starbucks and have a cup of coffee, you can also say, please, I want fair trade. And you can also say, please, can you sell me a China mug, and I'll take it home, wash it, and bring it back and use it every time. So you give up using those horrible paper cups. Another thing Starbucks do, you can get free coffee at Starbucks. This is a hoot, actually. They collect their used coffee grounds and bag them up in a really bright bag. I've got one on my shelf. I'm looking at it right now. And you can use the used coffee grounds as compost or as mulch in your garden.
Sure.
So this is the only free coffee you're ever likely to get from Starbucks.
Most likely. Michael Norton, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure.
More information about Michael Norton, his book, and some tips on how you can start making a difference is at our website, wfpl.org. To jockeys, horse racing is more than the sport of kings, it's also a business. Successful or not, riders must support their families, save for retirement, and insure themselves against career-ending injuries. But as Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton reports, the high cost of that insurance is putting a strain on many in the racing profession.
As he started his career, Bobby Ussery broke a lot of bones, but he never worried about health care. Ussery, who's best known for winning the 1967 Kentucky Derby aboard Proud Clarion, says catastrophic health insurance was provided.
The Guild had insurance. We had insurance. And we didn't have no problem with as long as we got hurt on the track. We were covered.
For decades, riders who suffer career-ending injuries were insured by the Jockeys Guild. Then a few years ago, the Guild quietly eliminated the coverage. The resulting firestorm fueled a congressional investigation and almost provoked federal intervention. The Jockey Insurance Fairness Act would have provided disability insurance by placing a tax on the simulcast of horse races. It died last year in a congressional committee and has not yet been reintroduced. Currently, racetracks offer some insurance, but for the most part, Early Fires, who won the Ashland Stakes in 1986, says jockeys must take care of themselves.
The racetrack does take care of us now for $1 million coverage if you get hurt on the racetrack. But sometimes it goes over and above that, then we have to pick it up and take care of the kids after that. And we're carrying 60 paraplegics right now. And the expenses got so high on us that we are really struggling to make it.
Chris McCarron, who twice won the Kentucky Derby, is raising money for disabled jockeys. A recent fundraiser organized by McCarron at the Kentucky Horse Park collected $50,000 in donations. And this week at Keeneland, Hall of Fame jockeys like McCarron, Usry, Fires, and Pat Day sold autographs for $5. The proceeds went to the National Thoroughbred Association's Disabled Jockeys Fund.
Eventually you're going to be back in the horse park.
Yeah, I want to build a campus over there, but I don't have a track right now.
Right.
While grateful for the generosity, McCarron would like to see the horse racing industry pay a share of those expenses. But he adds, a formula remains elusive.
That's a tough question to answer. It's a question that most of us up here have been asking for years, and we've been trying hard for years to figure out a way that the industry as a whole can help subsidize the cost of insurance for jockeys and for exercise riders and those who basically choose to put themselves in harm's way.
Part of the problem, according to Pat Day, who's Keeneland's all-time leading rider, is poor planning. Since legally, jockeys are independent contractors, Day says they need better business sense. He says today's apprentice jockeys must be trained to manage their finances.
Saving for the future, being more frugal with their money, being more diligent about paying attention while they're having the opportunities. Myself, I was 10 years trying to get focused and had a wonderful career, but I wonder what it would have been like had I been a little bit more focused in the first 10 years.
Besides his work fundraising for disabled jockeys, Chris McCarron is the power behind the North American Racing Academy, which this year began teaching young jockeys at the Kentucky Horse Park. Indeed, McCarron says part of their curriculum is money management.
They're going to learn financial life skills, so to speak. They're going to learn how to deal with banks, how to secure mortgages, and how to save money, how to do estate planning, and most importantly, how to shop for insurance and how know exactly how they need to cover themselves when they get out into the dangerous world of riding horses at 40 miles an hour.
But McCarron still holds out hope that when his students begin their racing careers in a couple of years, somehow they'll face fewer problems in finding catastrophic health care and disability insurance than those jockeys who are riding today. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
When we come back, Stephanie Sanders interviews three members of Louisville's Metro Council about the legislative body's growth and efficiency in the 4 years since merger. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, WFPL's Susan Sweeney Crum talks with author David Smedley Calvert about his time spent with Mayans and the information their culture can share with the world. First, though, we hear from three members of Louisville's Metro Council. WFPL's Stephanie Sanders will be bringing us portions of her interviews with each of the council's 26 members over the next several weeks. Today, we hear from representatives for Districts 1, 2, and 3. In District 1, Dr. Judy Green is a medical professional, civic activist, and mother to 2 biological and 11 adopted children. One of the newest members of Metro Council, Green was elected to her seat in 2006. Stephanie Sanders asked Green why she decided to enter politics.
You know, I feel that I could be a voice for people that may not have a voice. I feel like I could bring to fore some of the very unique issues that are happening in District 1. And I also feel like I could kind of bring together the two different geographical areas in District 1. As I said, have a large part of the West Louisville and large part of South Louisville. And what I want to do is to try to see how we can bridge those two communities to actually have one cohesive District 1.
And even though you've only been on a council for a few weeks so far, I mean, you clearly weren't living in a vacuum before that. So I guess tell me what your impression of Metro Council was or is now since you've been here. Is it working effectively for the city?
I think that the Metro Council is working very well for the city. I think that merger is one of the best things that could have happened to Louisville and Jefferson County. Again, in South Louisville, they say that they'd always been neglected. They'd been the stepchild. They really didn't have the same kind of services and opportunities that West Louisville and the urban district areas had. So I think merger has been positive. I think the formation of a 26-member council, members from all over the county, various backgrounds, various party denominations. I just think that that's been a good thing for the city of Louisville. So I hope that I can bring something to the table, bring some ideas, bring some of my thoughts about the community as a whole, because I look at the community, Louisville, as a whole community and not just District 1.
How has your first few weeks been? Have you been welcomed in, or you know, your meetings with your new caucus and things like that? How, just the kind of the initiation process, how has that gone for you?
Well, I do believe that I've been welcomed in. I think that, you know, my colleagues understand that it was an election that was held and people voted and the people made their choice. And, you know, everybody respects that. It's been very, very a whirlwind, I'll say. I've been on a whirlwind, to say the least. I've been here 6 weeks. Meeting with outside agencies and outside organizations and groups was very familiar to me because I knew most of them that are in my community. Learning this internal city government has been a little more of a challenge. And, you know, but it's a challenge, but it's also been an opportunity to meet some wonderful folks. So I've really enjoyed the first 6 weeks. It's been a whirlwind, but I won't complain.
District 2 Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin has held leadership roles on the four-year-old legislative body, serving as majority caucus chair and president of the council. Shanklin was elected to the council at its inception. She spoke with Stephanie Sanders at City Hall.
When you first ran for your seat, what made you want to run? What compelled you to be a part of Metro Council?
I had really been working in my community probably 30-something years. I worked at GE for 28 years, and as I worked at GE, I started a junior achievement for 8 years in the Newburgh area, so I knew the kid, you know, a lot of the kids. I had a Clothe the Child program at GE that we clothed the kids in the surrounding area at Christmas time, and I also did tutoring in the area. Plus, I wrote a newsletter for GE, so I was really familiar with the area, the people that live in the area. I was a council member out there, worked on the board, so I was already well known, and I decided that I was already doing all of this work free, so may as well get a small paycheck.
Well, tell me about what your impression of merger has been. Do you think it's working? Do you think it's kind of growing in its effectiveness?
I really like merger because when I was working in the Newburgh area on the Newburgh Council, there was no funding for anything. I think every year we got about $350 for our Newburgh Day Festival, and there was just no funding in this sort of the area in the county. Well, with merger, we've been able to put more funding all around in that area. Now, there are some areas that need funding more than others, you know, and then there's some that it takes money to clean up the area. But it's finally become an area, you know, with merger, we were able to have funding to run programs for needy kids, programs for low income. So the money is there, whereas it was not there before now.
When you look at the Metro Council and the members that are on it today, do you feel like the council is polarized or partisan?
It can be, and I say it can be on different issues, because when you have an area that's low income compared to an area that's the wealthiest areas in the city, there's a difference in things that they may not understand. And usually, I won't say all the time, but usually the Republicans are set up whereas they live in the areas that really don't need help as much as some of the other areas. And so it's some of the things they don't understand, but they're being educated and they're learning. And so, you know, it's becoming a lot easier than it was when we first started out. It was strictly just, you know, divided votes. But now we're learning to work together. We've had different ones come to my district and work just to see what happens in the Newburgh area. And it really means a lot. I had 7 Republicans to come to head brunch this last year with the Newburgh area. And it so they're understanding, and it means a lot to the community.
District 3 Councilwoman Mary Woolridge was elected to the first Metro Council during merger and previously served on the city's Board of Aldermen. She spoke with Stephanie Sanders about the council's effectiveness.
Do you think there are times when that effectiveness is compromised, or maybe you feel frustrated because of just the things that go along with politics, partisan voting, things like that?
I don't think it's, there is some partisan voting, but basically, what we do, if there's an issue, we try to talk to everybody, get everybody on board. And I don't know about the folk on the other side of the aisle, but in our caucus, we all try to agree on a particular issue, and so that it won't be partisan, whether the folk on the other side of the aisle sponsor it or whether we sponsor it. But I don't know how, what go on in their caucus. I see us being a lot less nonpartisan than what we were at first. I mean, usually it was 15 to 11. Everything was 15 to 11. And that is no longer true. So I don't see a lot of that going on anymore as it did in the past.
Do you think most Louisvillians have an accurate idea of what Metro Council is and how it works?
I think the majority of the folk probably have an idea. I mean, they probably related to the former Board of Aldermen, you know, people working together to make their city a more livable place where people want to come and raise their family. There are probably some people that's not as involved with what go on. But I can tell you, the people that are not quite as involved as others, you see them in the grocery, you see them everywhere, and it's like all of a sudden Metro TV is one of the stations they watch now. I saw you doing this. I saw her doing that. So people are really getting an education from that Metro station when they just look and listen. And whether they know what go on in government or not, they know who to call when there's an issue in their neighborhood or things like that. So I think people are pretty much up on what the Metro Council does.
Do you think that's an excellent segue to a question I wanted to ask you? Do you see your role as a Metro Council member more of an office where somebody can call when they have a problem and you help them get it fixed, or do you see your role more as being a legislator?
Basically, they can do both. I came into this job pretty much by being a legislative assistant to a former alderperson. I think I still hold on to part of that job, that where the assistant takes care of all these constituents' concerns, either or give them a number, a direction where they can get help. So they can do both that with me personally, as well as I am their legislator. I always have time to talk to my constituents and hopefully take care of their concerns and their needs. Although we do have a wonderful assistant, and she takes care of most of that, but I can honestly tell you some of my folk call, and they just want to talk to me and just want me to resolve whatever their concern is, and we're more than happy to do it.
The full interviews with Green, Shanklin, and Woolridge are available at our website, WFPL.org. From there, you can also learn more about the council members and determine who represents your district. Join us later this week as we air portions of Sanders' interviews with council members David Tandy, Sherry Bryant-Hamilton, and George Unsel. They'll air Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7:35 a.m. on WFPL. You can also hear them next week on Studio 619. When we come back, WFPL's Susan Sweeney Crum talks with author David Smedley Calvert about the years he spent living with Mayans and the books he's written about them. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. We've heard end of the world predictions for ages, but the ancient Mayans came up with a specific date. Based on the calendar the Mayans developed some 5,000 years ago, the Earth will end on December 21st, 2012. But that's just one of the fascinating aspects of the Mayan culture you can learn about in the books by author David Smedley Calvert. WFPL Susan Sweeney Crum spoke with Calvert about the years he spent living with the Mayan people, his books, and an effort he's leading to improve the availability of medical care to the Mayans, as most of them live in poverty.
You have an interesting catch line about your book here. The big line here is, will the Earth end on December 21st, 2012, as the Maya predict? And I know that that is just a small portion of what your book is about, but
right. Can
you kind of explain that first before I get into some of what you really have written about as well?
Yeah. Well, the Maya were obsessed with time. They still are. They had over 17 calendars. The three of the calendars are very well known, and one of them, scientifically very precise, is called the spiral round, it's a calendar that begins in 3114 BC and it ends in 6 years on the vernal equinox.
What has led them in your learning or relationship with them to come up with that the calendar ends then?
Well, that day, December 21st, 2012, the sun is exactly in the middle of the Milky Way. Now, that coincides with the Maya religion, showing that when the sun is right there, then it opens up the gateways into heaven and all the souls that are waiting. They ride canoes into the heavens and become gods. And so if you look at the Maya Tree of Life, it is the Milky Way. And the sun coinciding there is taking over 25,000 years to arrive. So it's not happenstance. How did they know in 3114 B.C. that the sun would be in the middle of the Milky Way December 21st, 2012? It's a good question, isn't it?
Is this something they still believe or know or live by in the year 2007?
There are people there are people in the culture who do. There are timekeepers in Guatemala and in Chiapas. That being said, the majority of the Maya today live as peasants and farmers, and they live at one with the earth. Lots of them don't even have electricity, and they live very happy. They're actually very happy. They live a life with very little stress.
Your book and is primarily about your relationship with the Mayan people, and you have two books about that. Is that right?
Yeah, one book, In the Land of the Maya, is a book written about the culture. In fact, it starts from the day the people walked across the Beringa Straits into the North America and then into Central and South America, and right up until today, where young men are being taken out of the village to work as cement masons, and they're learning things that are not Maya, they're not of the culture, and they're taking them back to their villages. And unfortunately, 6 weeks ago, I was in the Yucatan, and I had to go to the funeral of six men who died in a car wreck on their way to Playa del Carmen to work as cement masons. It's just a terrible thing. These guys, normally they would have stayed there, taking care of their families and raised corn.
So is there not an upside at all? I mean, I see that would want to maintain their traditions, their beliefs, their culture, but can they survive without somehow looking at employment somewhere outside of their village?
That's the dilemma. The things that are of the 21st century, you can't buy by selling a small amount of corn. Money has become a universal thing, and it's even reached down to the Maya pueblos now, where the women are making hammocks, and they make very wonderful hammocks for themselves and for the Yucatecans. But the hammocks that they make for tourists, they've learned tourists don't know anything about hammocks, so they're very crude, and they make them very quickly, and they make money that way. Artesanías, which you'd call arts and crafts in English, they make those and sell them to the tourists. So, the other thing that the men can do is go work in construction. And because of where it is, Cancun, Playa del Carmen, Tulum, and those places, there's a lot of work for these guys. And they are leaving the villages, and they're changing the life of the Maya and the culture in that way.
How did you come to have this relationship with them and develop your interest in the Mayan culture?
Well, as normally happens, I went down there on business, a woman ruined my life.
Sounds like a romance.
Well,
a bad
it was.
One that went bad.
No, it didn't go bad. Oh. That's what happened, and then I moved down there. I was down there for, over 10 years.
Living with them or among them or just...
Yeah.
And what did you learn? And this is what you're sharing in your books, I'm assuming, in addition to some of the work you want to do for... And I want to get into that as well, the foundation you have. But what did you learn while you were living with them?
Well, they are connected to the earth and the cycle of life. The Maya have a belief, habichuelas, where the first 12 days of every year, whatever happens on that day, like the 1st of January, the 2nd, that's the way the month that coincides will be. If it rains on that day, then that'll be a rainy month. If there's storms on the 10th day, then October will be stormy. They believe in all kinds of things like that. And in the book itself, I mean, there are beliefs and you say creencias in Spanish, but things that they absolutely believe that nobody but they believe that a Kukulcan, which is a feathered serpent, flies over the Yucatan twice a year, and if anything of yours is touched by one of its feathers when it falls, then it could come to life, like a shirt. So they bring in everything. On those days, they don't leave anything out at night. They fill their house up with everything they own so that nothing that they own will be touched by a feather of the flying serpent.
It sounds like it must have been a fascinating experience for you being with him. And is this what you want to share with people in your books?
Exactly. Well, the book 100 Ruins of the Maya is nothing more than a description of 100 ruins that you're going to see and where you can decide whether you want to go there or not, how to get there, how long it takes, is it worth the trip, where it's at, you know, what when was that city built, at what time did it fall, what was the height, it's a description of Maya constructions, how they built, and of 100 ruins. The other book, In the Land of the Maya, is more about the culture itself from the very beginning up until today. And we discuss stuff like wars in the book, things that you wouldn't normally know. But I would say this. The book is written, you do not need to be an anthropologist or an archaeologist to understand the book. It's written in a way that people who don't want to study the Maya can read the book and still enjoy the heck out of it.
I was in Belize last year and then in Mexico this year and saw Mayan ruins in both places and learned a whole lot more this time. But and you touched on some of it and when you talked about their the way they lived and what they built. The way they described it to us, though, was that part of the reason for the demise or the collapse of the society was as they got their villages got too crowded and some of the peasants started moving out, which is, I guess the people told us, the people who are still living are basically the peasants who moved out and went into their own agricultural lives. But because all of the working people left and nobody else, of course, wanted to work because they weren't used to it, it basically sort of imploded. And if they were smart enough to have the calendar and all the stuff, was there not an effort to or thinking in terms of how to save their society as it started to fall in on itself?
That's a good question. Where did the Maya go, and why did the collapse of the southern cities, well, they collapsed all about the same time when the northern cities started growing. What you're going to find is if you get 20 anthropologists and archaeologists in a room and say, what happened, why did the fall of the Maya occur, you're going to get some arguments and some big ones. I mean, people are looking at things like food supply. The cities got too big. The cities got so big that they couldn't feed the people. Well, that may be true in some places, but in other places, scientists have pointed out there's an inexhaustible food supply. So that couldn't have been the reason. My personal thinking is that the people got tired of the elite class, who were a very small percentage, running everything. And the other people were treated like slaves. And I think that at the end of the day, in 20 years, as we uncover more cities and we get more hieroglyphics and more information, I think we're going to find at the end of the day that what happened is the people just didn't want to play religion anymore and that they just stopped and they went back to farming.
Well, I found it fascinating just the little bit of time we had there and seeing the ruins and hearing about it. And seeing, you forget that there were thousands of people who lived in some of these cities. But do you have the belief that the people who are left are the ones who, I mean, the way she described it is, as the people scattered, that's where they are now, these villages that are, I mean, the people who mostly are still alive today are descendants of the ones who left and went out and started their own lives, as you said, in the agriculture.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that.
And the other issue, it sounds like, that you have a real interest in is this convergence, I guess, of their culture and the modern world, and they're seeking when they need help or medical help. Our Brother's House that you have, is that something you started? And tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we started Our Brother's House because we saw a need. If you understand what happens in the healthcare systems, the poor people have to leave the jungle, basically, where they live, and they're very poor people, and they have to go to the cities. They're not equipped. Either they don't have money to get a room. Fathers to stay on the street with their children for up to 2 or 3 days, for 4 days, eating potato chips because they don't have any money, and they sleep under cars. And in these cities, terrible things can happen. They're at great risk. So people don't go to the cities. Women will stay in their village and die instead of getting medical treatment because they just don't want to go to the cities. They don't want to put their families at risk, and they're not equipped to do so. So we developed a way. My brother's house is a program that we developed. We want to build shelters on the bottom floor and a couple of suites for tourism on the top floor so that these shelters would never, ever need a dime of they would never have to borrow money or look for donations. The tourism on the top floor would provide food and lodging for the Maya on the ground floor. They would never see each other. There would be different entrances. But the way we developed it is where, but also, whoever rented the suites would have the best vacation ever because they would come with a chauffeur, a van, a maid, and a cook, thus providing jobs for people. And all that tourism money would go back in to help the indigenous people.
Would these be, obviously, like you said, closer to the, I mean, right outside the big city, but close enough to their villages where they could come, go back and forth? How do you see that working?
They can get, there are taxis and buses. They can get from their villages to the cities, and they could get to the shelters. And once they know that they're there, that's what would happen. They would come to the shelters, and each one of our shelters will have a van so that we, you know, and if we had to go out and get somebody that was really sick, we could. But also, the shelters would not just be used for that. They would also be used for the welfare system so that if the city needed to put a family in a shelter for a couple of days, you know, we could do that. That's what the whole, we would never turn anybody away.
It sounds like a great idea. Have you actually started to implement this? Are you still fundraising to start this? Where are you in this effort?
Well, we have our website, maya-aid.com, and on there, the books are for sale. All the proceeds from the sale of the books go to build the shelter. And we're programming Baya Dalid as our first shelter. We have the land. The land was donated by the city, but we're just starting the sale of these books and radio programs like yours and newspaper articles that should be coming out. Hopefully in the next 6 months we'll raise enough money to go ahead and build the full first shelter. And once it starts, they'll also raise money to build the other shelters. They don't cost that much money to build in Mexico if you know what you're doing. They don't. And we'd like to get all six shelters up and running within the next 18 months, if that's possible.
And that your locations are chosen based on where some of the largest populations are? Or
they're based on need, yeah. In Mérida, Valladolid, in Cancun, Chetumal, Chan Santa Cruz Bravo, and Tizimín. Those are the big cities. And they're the ones where the people go from their jungle villages and they go to the hospitals, and they don't have anywhere to stay.
Are you getting? Are you doing this mostly with, in terms of your fundraising and trying to get this going through the U.S., or do you have a good partnership in some of the Central American countries with people there who are helping you do this?
No, we don't right now. And Central America is poverty stricken, and if you anywhere you go down there, you'll find a need. So. You know, rather than we did when we first started, we wanted to work with Latin America and with Mexico, and everybody wanted to help, but nobody ever did anything. So we just decided to do this ourselves, and that's what we're doing. We're doing it ourselves. I was told by a psychic in England that Ricky Martin was going to join us. He's very concerned about Latin American children. And she said, no, not right now, but once you get going, Ricky Martin's going to join you. She said, I see that. And I said, you mean Ricky Martin, the singer? Because I have seen him.
More information on Mayans and David Smedley Calvert can be found on our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.